Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also later at alexlinder.com when complete. Today we're going to resume with The Nation of Islam's DeLeo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, Volume 3 in their series. The first two concern Jewish domination of the slave trade and domination of the slave for the products slaves produced in the Americas. This is Volume 3 about Leo Frank. We've just heard about how the Jews acted after the trial, setting up the Truth is on the March advertising campaign, enlisting the owner of the New York Times, the father of modern advertising, and the number one most prominent Jew in America, Lewis Marshall, to lead a campaign to essentially demonize Georgia, the South, whites, America, anything they could to get Leo Frank off, even though they knew he was guilty. They didn't care. And today we're going to hear the response coming from Georgia, led mainly by Tom Watson. And we'll start on page 236. This chapter has about, not a chapter, this section, this major section has about 60, 70 pages to go, so we'll do some portion of that today and quit where it's logical. But we start on page 236. Georgia responds, the Tom Watson effect. Thomas, Tom E. Watson, was the strongest of those Georgia voices that took deadly aim at the media blitzkrieg from the north. The media blitzkrieg, arranged by Albert Lasker, father of modern advertising. We heard about last session. A powerful personality in Georgia politics, he wrote and published a weekly newspaper he called The Jeffersonian, and a monthly titled Watson's Magazine. So he's doing a weekly and a monthly. And again, as contrasted with the three daily newspapers down there in Georgia, in Atlanta, that are dominated by Jews, if not owned by them. One's owned by Hearst, others, but they all have Jews as senior editors. And the coverage, as we've heard in earlier sessions, was tilted to be pro-Frank. And it was only after his conviction, moving forward, the ADL and other Jew groups would lie that the coverage and the crowds were anti-Semitic. No, the South was pro-Philo-Semitic. Not anti-Semitic. They were pro-Jew, not anti-Jew, because of they were Protestants operating out of the Old Testament. But this case was the turning point after the case, what Leo Frank did, and more importantly than what he did, because every race could have a bad apple, is how the Jews responded to their man being a pedophile, rapist, murderer. They responded by backing him, not accepting his guilt, not accepting his punishment, but by blaming the whites of Atlanta and Georgia and the South. And that's what Jews always do. They're a race of liars, and they always defend their own. They don't care what they did, because Goyim have no rights in their so-called religion. They only exist to serve Jews. And the Jews will tell any lie that appears best calculated in the moment to advance their cause. So they ignored the South as Philo-Semitic. They ignored Jews' role in slavery. They turned history on its head in order to create the false idea that Leo Frank wasn't found guilty on the evidence, but was found guilty due to prejudice and intimidation. And then after his conviction, they as I said, they started a whole campaign to get him a new trial, and they told lie after lie after lie. They smeared and defamed this region, and now Thomas Watson, Tom E. Watson, is standing up to defend his region. And he publishes a weekly paper and a monthly magazine, Watson's Magazine and the Jeffersonian Weekly. Many Jews have claimed that the influential Georgia populist and attorney stoked the flames of anti-Semitism throughout the trial, and many, like Frank's main attorney, Lewis Marshall, laid blame for the lynching of Frank at Watson's doorstep. This is how Watson's role is typically characterized. Quote, while waiting for the grand jury to act, Thomas E. Watson, populist candidate for president, capital P, that was a populist party, author and journalist and rabid professional Southerner, proceeded in his newspapers to try, convict, and execute Leo Frank, Yankee Jew and employer of Dixie's white womanhood. There was a footnote. Watson was no different from most whites and Jews of his time and his negative beliefs about blacks. Earlier in his career, however, he actually had publicly expressed belief in the right of blacks to political equality, a position that found no takers among Southern Jews. See Woodward, Tom Watson, 220-21, and Dinnerstein, Leo Frank case. After the lynching of Leo Frank, Watson was charged by the New York Times with fanning race hatred. They said that in 1915. Again, the three big figures in this campaign of demonizing the South and lying about Leo Frank. Number one was Albert Lasker, then Lewis Marshall, and then Adolf Ox of the New York Times, we heard about last session, ran dozens of stories after the conviction in the New York Times, taking Leo Frank's side. Jewish historian Murray Friedman claimed that Frank's lawyers used their racist courtroom language rhetorically and only in response to Tom Watson's anti-Semitic rhetoric. And writer Harry Golden claimed that Watson was, quote, directly responsible for fomenting the only European-type pogrom against a Jewish community in the history of the United States. These and other writers eager to reinforce an invented anti-Semitism narrative have simply misrepresented Watson's role in the Frank case. The fact is, the trial lasted from July 28th to August 26, 1913, so only a month, when Frank was sentenced to die, like exactly 4 months after the murder. But Watson published his first words in the case on March 19th, 1914, 7 months after Leo Frank had been convicted. And just in the 30 days before Watson's first commentary, the New York Times had printed 14 anti-black, racism-filled articles as part of Frank's, quote, Truth on the March, unquote, campaign. Not one article even remotely resembling objective journalism. So Watson didn't even get into this until more than half a year after the conclusion of the case. Once involved, Watson's approach was at first almost entirely defensive. He simply reprinted the New York Times' most offensive claims about the trial and then corrected the record in strident defense of George's honor. The aggressive post-trial campaign mounted by Frank's new public relations team and their astonishing disregard for the facts of the case fed Watson's indignation. Lasker himself assessed his efforts on Frank's behalf. Before that quote, let's look at an inset graphic as an example of the lies that the New York Times under Alfred Ox was publishing. Headline, Frank convicted by mob, end quotes. Prosecutor obeyed prejudice, counsel asserts, arguing for new trial, special to the New York Times. That the conviction of Leo M. Frank of the murder of Mary Fagan was accomplished by crookedness, by the playing of cards under the table, and by the pulling of every string of prejudice, was the accusation made this afternoon by attorney Reuben Arnold in concluding his argument for a new trial for Frank. So, just overt lying. And the caption reads, New York Times articles like this one, October 28, 1913, and many that followed, enraged Georgians and drove them to support Tom Watson's Jeffersonian. So, all right, back to the text proper. Lasker himself assessed his efforts, the father of modern advertising behind Leo Frank, on Frank's behalf. Quote, this is Lasker, the Jew, talking about what he's doing to defend Frank, guilty, convicted. We indicted the whole people of Georgia. Well, then, as was natural in any group you solidify, we put the whole state of Georgia on trial, and we did what is so often done, and the cure that we gave for the disease, we increased the disease. Watson reacted strongly to that attack on, quote, the whole people of Georgia, and his first comments in the Jeffersonian represented the Georgian people's growing disdain for Frank's new extra-legal, quote, cure, quote, according to law and to uniform practice, Frank has had a fair trial and has been justly condemned. Where shall our murder case be tried? Cases be tried. Are the newspapers to do it? Are the pulpits to do it? If so, let us try all of them the same way. Let us not have one law for the rich and another for the poor. Soon this rather mild indignation morphed into a vigorous counterinsurgency that struck a militant chord with white Georgians. Watson was not a mere ideologue. He was a lawyer of many years, he was 58 years old by this time, who was well acquainted with the fine points of both Georgia state law and the Frank case. His painstaking analysis of the trial, evidence, and strict attention to the official record, punctuated with flourishes of common white man outrage, made him the unbossed champion of Georgia's virtue. By early 1914, the three Atlanta dailies had been bullied into a position favorable to Frank's cause. Once aggressive in their reportage and trial coverage, the city's newspapers now kept a fixed eye on their substantial Jewish advertisement revenues. And no one could help but notice that not one of the dailies tendered a response to the northern assault on their state and its blatant misrepresentation of the trial record. The Atlanta media's curious new orientation seemed to many to coincide with the rumored flood of funds pouring into the state to be used on Frank's behalf. But there was one glaring exception to the Frank team's efforts to muzzle the local press. They were unable to control the unsparing rhetoric of Thomas E. Watson. They were completely confounded by Watson's dissection of every aspect of Mary Fagan's murder, and Georgians reveled in his weekly jousting with the big northern media combines. No one could deny that Watson expressively articulated the common white Georgians' resentment. Quote, "Never before did any criminal who had exhausted in his own behalf every known right, privilege, and precedent of law resort to such a systematic and unprecedented crusade against civilized tribunals, orderly methods, and legally established results. Never before in the history of this country has any convicted criminal been given the freedom of the daily newspapers that Frank has enjoyed." It's Tom Watson. Watson directly countered Frank's attempts to create, quote, anti-Semitism out of whole cloth by citing the, quote, rich Jews as the major offenders. The owners of the New York World, the Pulitzers, and the New York Times' Adolf Ox, I mistakenly said Albert, it's Adolf Ox, who owned the New York Times. Watson, a decorated racist himself, could readily see through Leo Frank's Negro testimony as anti-Semitism ploy. Quote, "The great point emphasized by the Jewish papers is that witnesses against Frank was a Negro. A witness against Frank was a Negro. It seems that Negroes are good enough to kill our ballots, make our laws, hold office, sleep in our beds, eat at our tables, marry our daughters, and mongrelize the Anglo-Saxon race, but are not good enough to bear testimony against a rich Jew." So even back then, the Jews were pushing miscegenation. He's making the point, yeah, you're racist when it comes to you, but you're anti-racist when it comes to whites. Oney comments that for Watson, the implicit racism of many of the defense's allies was, of course, a fat target. Astonished at the, quote, untold millions expended in the state on Frank's behalf, Watson railed at the seemingly endless appeals process that taxed Georgia's budget and its patience. There is no doubt that Tom Watson's rhetoric ultimately targeted Jews who championed the cause of, quote, a Jew pervert, but Watson offered Georgians far more legitimate legal analysis than the transparent propaganda in which the Times' Adolf Ox trafficked. Watson quoted at length from the brief of evidence, the official trial summary, that Frank's lawyers approved of without dispute, but that Frank's team was loath to touch. The facts aren't on their side, so they try to ignore them. Georgians appreciated Watson's take on the case, which was the kind of analysis that Frank's team assiduously avoided. As Lasker and the New York Times had become the prosecutors, Watson took up the defense. He filled in gaps in the layman's legal understanding of points of order, trial rules, due process, and courtroom strategy. For example, of the bloody fingerprints found in the factory's basement door, Watson said, "Let me here remind the reader that Jim Conley, a state's witness, could have been required by Leo Frank's lawyers to make the imprint of his fingers while he was on the stand, and if these fingerprints had resembled those made in the back door, Frank would have gone free, and the Negro would have swung." Watson pinpointed the blunders and the mishandling of the case by Frank's main attorneys, Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold, and challenged them both to debate him in print, offering them as much space as they would require. But their shrinking from the offer, like Frank's refusal to confront Jim Connolly, preferring to be heard only through a northern enemy's megaphone, only increased Watson's legend and momentum. He drew biblical parallels to the case that subtly brought Frank's Jewishness into question. Watson reminded the Jews that it was Frank himself who brought out his Jewishness at the trial, and no one else, and, quote, if the Jews are so rash as to identify the whole race with its worst member, what can they expect? Other races don't make that mistake, unquote. If the Jews are so rash as to identify the whole race with its worst member, what can they expect? Other races don't make that mistake. He asked, quote, why should Jews and the Gentile champions of Leo Frank virtually claim that the whole Hebrew race was struck at when one convicted pervert and murderer was punished as Mosaic law would have him punished? If all Jews are incapable of crime, why the Decalogue and Leviticus? After the lynching of Leo Frank, Watson was unapologetic. Leo Frank, this is a quote, Leo Frank was put to death in obedience to legal sentence after his just conviction had been sustained by the highest courts. We couldn't allow rich Jews to reverse our Supreme Courts. We couldn't allow them to substitute Talmudic teaching for the penal code of Georgia. The nation's premier advertising mind, Albert Lasker, and newspaper magnate, Adolf Ox, had experience only in one-way messaging, and they were utterly unprepared for an actual two-way debate. And Leo Frank's team of propagandists and promoters ignored Watson at their own peril. Their absence from the exchange allowed Watson's commentary to hold sway in Georgia. Certainly the Jewish assault on Georgia instigated and whipped up Watson's anti-Frank rhetoric, but Watson had been openly, profoundly, and violently racist for years and years. And during those years, according to Dr. Lindemann, quote, Jewish merchants bought advertising space in Watson's paper, and Watson often praised the city's Jews and notably avoided calling attention to anti-populist sentiment among them. So he had no history of not getting along. He got along with the Jews before this, and he was openly racist. As an attorney, he once defended a Jewish defendant against murder charges, stating in his closing argument, quote, no Jew can do murder. Well, that's laughably untrue. Alongside his commentary on the Frank case, the Jeffersonian ran articles that defended Jews from what Watson saw as their oppressors, Catholics. In an article titled, Won't the Roman Catholics Ever Quit Persecuting the Jews?, he railed at how the Catholics, quote, barbarously persecuted the kindred of Mary, the peaceable Jews. In the very same issue, his front page headline screamed, Here come the Negro priests preaching in the South. The Italian Pope is after our niggers. Complete with a cartoon showing a virginal white woman in a confession booth alone with a burly black priest with his, quote, thick woolly head. Can you imagine, he asked, a deadlier danger to morals? And Watson acknowledged, respected, and defended the Jews' claim to the Holy Land. So he's as Philo-Semitic going in as the rest of the South. At the very moment of Leo Frank's arrest for the murder of Mary Fagan in late April of 1913, Watson's Jeffersonian was demanding that white politicians remove blacks from all government positions, advocating lynching, and referring to blacks as niggers and coons. And to top it off, he was an avid and open supporter of the Ku Klux Klan. According to the Journal of Negro History, quote, the black male fared even worse at the hands of Watson, who insisted on the frequent use of brute force to, quote, control Negroes, and on flogging, if for no other reason than for their color and their smell. Footnote 591. It should be noted that Watson had no hesitation at all in voicing his belief in full and complete white superiority and black inferiority. For example, see Canada and the Color Line from the Jeffersonian in 1911. Quote, without the aid of whites, Negroes of Africa will never be other than savages. The white nation should adopt a settled policy on this grave question and should adhere to it rigidly. In all affairs of government, the whites exclusively should control. Other of the many examples in the Jeffersonian include advocating mob law and lynching of blacks. Quote, three typical Negro bucks enjoin their Sunday in a typical nigger buck way, soak themselves in the meanest of liquor, and at length prowl around seeking for typical nigger buck prey, an unprotected white woman. So he is very, very anti-black going in. Yet, with full knowledge of Watson's racial bigotry, Jewish leaders of the B'nai B'rith sought his legal services to aid their embattled president, offering him a $5,000 retainer. Atlanta Jews and Leo Frank himself understood and supported Watson's sentiments and sought his special skills as they geared up to lay the blame for Mary Fagan's murder on, quote, a Negro. Indeed, Watson's racism was indistinguishable from that of Adolph Ox at the New York Times, whose editorials spoke of the, quote, coon, quote, nigger, quote, darky, and mammy, in reference to America's black citizenry. As a populist leader of 20 years earlier, Watson had at least tried cross-racial political organizing. Speaking with white and black sharecroppers ensnared by the crop lien system, L-I-E-N, he had often argued, you are kept apart that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the arch of financial despotism, which enslaves you both. Jews, on the other hand, had always avidly and unwaveringly espoused white supremacy for as long as they had resided in Dixie. A large proportion of their members were in the merchant class and among the prime economic beneficiaries of the sharecropping system. They vehemently rejected Watson's brand of populism. And Watson soon, quote, reformed his racial views to align more closely with those of the people of the book. So when they sought their best legal weapon in defense of the accused B'nai B'rith leader, Watson was their man. He refused their offer, and that may help explain why he made no mention of the case until 7 months after the trial. And what role did Tom Watson play in inciting the lynching, or as Watson called it, the, quote, irregular execution of Leo Frank? According to interviews conducted by one scholar, quote, the lynch mob that did kill Frank was composed of coldly determined men who had vowed to see that Frank died even before Watson's tirade began. It is ironically improbable that he influenced appreciably the actions of the ones that who did put Frank to death. Anti-Semite or not, it is clear that Tom Watson's outrage was generated by his belief that Leo Frank was a sexual predator. The willingness of the international Jewish community to rally around Frank as a Jew and ignore his sexual crimes against a Gentile child is what brought out Watson's ire, just as the willingness of Georgia courts to accept Negro testimony brought out the racism of Adolph Ox, the racism of attorneys Rosser and Arnold, and the racism of Leo Frank himself. After Frank's lynching in 1915, the entire state conservative ticket, backed by Watson, was elected. And, according to scholar Mark Bauman, some Jewish businessmen in Atlanta actually participated within the conservative faction. Ironically, Frank's patron saint, Albert Lasker, acknowledged the wisdom of Watson's point of view. Quote, Lasker says, I made a great mistake. Georgia, which had kept it quiet, resented the pressure from outsiders. Yes, I want to make up to Georgia for what I did to them then, because there is where our greatest mistake was, because there is where our greatest mistake was when we took and flashed this all over the country. So the father of advertising is admitting he made a mistake in demonizing Georgia. In retrospect, he said, he would have told Ox and other pressmen, quote, we don't want you to print a word. We want you to tell this to people who have economic connections in Georgia, and we want them to talk to the economic leaders of the South. We want them to go down to Washington and talk to them quietly as if nothing was going on. If we had done that, I think we would have saved the boy's life. But when we put this tremendous pressure on all of them, the state was indicted, And there came a unanimous opinion in Georgia that he was guilty. So I handled it badly, admits Lasker. We didn't understand the psychology. The boy was commuted and lynched. I got him lynched instead of hung. That is all that happened. Lasker ultimately conceded that Watson was, in his opinion, quote, a very brilliant man. And Watson very much looked like Steve Spurrier, the football coach. He had that same kind of, like, sharp-eyedness. Last, scholars like Harry Golden and Leonard Dinnerstein have intimated that Watson was motivated by greed after seeing that Leo Frank, quote, turned into the greatest sales bonanza in the Jeffersonian's history, unquote. If this is so, then Watson was the last aboard a long, long train that included many pro-Frank newspapers like the New York Times and the Jewish Daily Forward. As shown, publisher Abraham Kahan took a special interest in Frank that seemed to have far more to do with his struggling paper's circulation than with any righteous indignation at Frank's plight. Scholar Jason Schulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, charged Kahan, C-A-H-A-N, with exploiting the Frank case for cash profit. Quote, Kahan, seeing how much attention the Frank affair was receiving in the mainstream press, took advantage of the moment and devised a plan to, quote, Americanize, unquote, his Forward readers. Again, this is for the Eastern European Jews streaming into New York. The Forward is basically a Bolshevik socialist paper published for them, so he's putting in Leo Frank because it's selling copies. So he devised a plan to Americanize his Forward readers by simply mimicking the American press. Despite Kahan's efforts, if the Forward readers did not buy the newspaper, all his efforts would have been in vain. But the Yiddish-speaking immigrants could not be satiated by news of the Frank affair, so they were avid for it. On 19 August 1915, just 2 days after Frank's murder, the Forward announced its new circulation, 200,267, almost a 50% increase from the pre-Frank affair figure. Kahan's biographer Theodore Pollock correctly points out that this act of regional insanity contributed to the growth of the Forward. In his exploitation of the Frank case, Kahan did with the Forward what Tom Watson was charged with doing for his Jeffersonian newspaper. Next subsection, Leo Frank's Bumbling Private Eyes. Two epigraphs. 9/10 of the private detectives, so-called, are the worst lot of blackmailing crooks and scoundrels that ever went unhanged. I am trying to cloak this business with an air of respectability and honesty, but it has been the stamping ground for the worst kind of crooks for so long that it is a hard job. That's from William J. Burns, private detective hired by Leo Frank. Again, Burns and Pinkerton are the two biggest detective agencies, and both were hired to work to defend Leo Frank, and both independently arrived at the conviction that he was guilty of the murder of Mary Fagan. And then secondly, undoubtedly, someone interested in the Leo Frank defense employed dishonest detectives. Someone, that's from the ADL, lying as usual, like they don't know who the someone is. As Leo Frank's retooled defense team propagandized the public on an unprecedented international scale, they pursued the legal track within Georgia's appellate court system in their campaign to save the prisoner's life. Again, 13 appeals, all denied. And the conclusion confirmed. Several unsuccessful appeals in Georgia State Court served to delay his execution throughout 1913 and into a very eventful 1914. His New York-based public relations assault on Georgia was antagonistic enough, but Frank also employed other strategies that only added to his many legal woes. Part of his plan involved a radical reexamination of the most damaging trial evidence. So in March of 1914, Frank hired the greatest sleuth in the world, quote-unquote, William J. Burns, to perform that delicate assignment. The Burns agency had first been employed early in the case when Frank was arrested, but it soon withdrew, citing the surrounding legal and illegal chaos. But its withdrawal probably had more to do with a rather resolute conclusion drawn by Burns' head detective, C.W. Tobie, T-O-B-I-E, When it was suggested by a reporter that he was trying to shield Frank from the police investigation, Toby responded, "That is absurd. From what I developed in my investigation, I am convinced that Frank is the guilty man. We were working on the theory that he was the murderer." Clearly, that investigative arrangement did not work out for Leo Frank. The Pinkerton agency, which had also been employed by Frank, had fallen out of favor because its agent, Harry Scott, like Burns' agent, had come to believe that Frank was the lone murderer of Mary Fagan. But with the passing of a year since that initial engagement, Burns this time came himself, descending upon Atlanta, ready to employ any means necessary to exonerate Leo Frank of Mary Fagan's murder. Publicly, Frank and his friends feigned ignorance of Burns' role and actually denied that they had any connection to him at all. Appearing to be running interference, the Atlanta Constitution assured its readers that, quote, "Leo Frank knows nothing of the decision of William J. Burns to investigate the Fagan murder. That is, he knows nothing except what he has learned from the newspapers. It is generally conceded that Burns will not be associated with the prisoner's defense. His investigation, it is said, will be conducted independently. As yet, he has not accepted employment at the hands of Frank or his friends, and it may be that he will not be employed by anyone." All this was subterfuge. Frank's posture suggests that he wanted to keep a safe distance from the activities he and his legal team knew Burns would be engaged in. But Burns himself let slip to the press that it was Frank's friends who had employed him. Albert Lasker told his biographer that when he contacted fellow Jew Adolph Ochs of the New York Times, quote, "His second suggestion to me was that I retain William Burns, whom he had the greatest confidence in. Burns cost me $25,000 out of my own pocket." Footnote 611, Lasker, Interview 5, later in more apparent subterfuge, the well-known dentist, Dr. B. Wildauer, and fellow B'nai B'rith Lodge member Milton Klein took credit for Burns' hire. Wildauer was formerly the only Jew in the police force, and in 1903 he said a police commissioner, quote, had offered to make him detective if he would use his influence among the Jews against a certain mayoralty candidate. Pompous and self-aggrandizing, the celebrated private eye presented himself as a meticulous investigator of complex crimes. But unbeknownst to most, Burns brought with him to Atlanta fresh wounds to his reputation, inflicted by no less of a power than President William H. Taft. Taft had pardoned an Oregon man convicted of land theft because Burns was found to have rigged the jury, among other misdeeds. A few years before that, in 1908, Burns was involved in a San Francisco corruption case in which he was suspected of dynamiting several buildings to make it appear to be the act of a key figure in the case, the Jewish political Abe Ruef, R-U-E-F. Now, for a hefty $4,500 retainer, $100,000 in today's dollars, from Lasker, Burns would put his international, quote, expertise to work in Atlanta on Leo Frank's behalf. The slapstick comedy troupe Keystone Cops was just beginning their silent movie career in 1914, but it would be no surprise if it were found that they were inspired by the comically inept William J. Burns Detective Agency. Burns could not have made a worse first impression, promising Atlantans that he would resolve the already solved crime and clear up the murder, quote, mystery, unquote, without delay. He called the Atlanta police stupid and pointed out that the mayor himself had publicly called them incompetent. As a rule, he pompously and prophetically professed, private detectives were, quote, a bunch of liars, crooks, and incapable asses masquerading under the bogus title of detective. And with those introductory remarks, the greatest of all detectives set about ferreting out the crime of the century. With Frank only weeks away from the gallows, Burns had precious few days to, quote, obtain evidence that would convincingly and decisively exonerate his, quote, secret client. While Frank's legal team was filing brief after brief, seeking a new trial in every possible venue, Burns and his men were in the trenches re-interviewing witnesses and tracking down new leads. And then something strange began to happen. Several of the trial witnesses who had been in the company of Burns came down with memory loss or changes of heart, claiming they were now ready to reverse their testimony if Frank were granted a new trial. And as these miracle retractions began to pile up, the scoop-hungry press fed off each revelation, making it appear that the conviction of Frank was not as airtight as had been presumed. At the trial, the prosecution proved that Frank murdered Mary Fagan on the second floor, but the defense claimed Conley pushed her into the basement from the first floor and strangled her there. Astoundingly, bunch of bullets here. Burns found a woman who claimed she was walking by the pencil factory at the exact time of the murder and heard the agonized pleading of the girl who was being tortured in the factory basement. And the woman could tell by the girl's voice that her attacker was not a white man. Said she, "I thought some Negro was whipping or killing his wife." Or, curiously, "some Negro riot was occurring." Next bullet. Burns, quote, found a pencil factory employee named Cora L. Lefew, L-E-F-F-E-W, who now claimed to have seen the strands of hair on the second floor machine and was certain they were not Mary's. Again, Burns found another named Georgia Denham, who claimed to have had a conversation with James Conley in which she asked him about stains on his shirt, the ones which are said to have instigated his arrest. Quote, "the Negro told her and no one else that the stains were not rust but blood and that his nose had been bleeding. She also explained why she had withheld this damning information for over a year. She blamed city detectives who took her affidavit and then ignored it." Burns found a white Baptist preacher named C.B. Ragsdale who swore that he had overheard, quote, "two darkies talking on the street and that one of them was James Conley, whom he heard confess to the crime." Burns found two prominent Jews who, all of a sudden, remembered that they had seen Frank on the street at exactly the same time necessary to provide an alibi for him. Frank, all of a sudden, a full half year after his conviction, remembered seeing them as well. Burns found the mother of a factory employee who, exactly 1 year after the murder, remembered that she was actually in Frank's office when Mary Fagan arrived there and saw her leave as Frank remained in his office. Finally, one drunk girl, quote, came forward, claiming that Conley had made drunken advances to her just a week before Mary Fagan's murder in, quote, exactly the same spot where the Frank lawyers claimed Conley killed Fagan. This same, quote, little factory girl had earlier testified in court during Frank's trial, but had made no mention of the alleged incident. So all these suspicious new findings from the detective are obviously concocted. His legend amplified with every newspaper edition, and Burns succeeded in turning many of those evidentiary molehills into major mountains of doubt about the verdict in the public mind outside Georgia. To rank-and-file Georgians, it had all the stench of bribery, graft, and fraud, and rumors of such were rampant, and the local press seemed uncritically accepting of it all. Next section, Leo Frank, "I am not a pervert," direct quote. Frank's lawyers believed that the jury was influenced as much by the unchallenged charges of Frank's sexual lewdness as by the murder evidence. Indeed, Frank himself believed that, quote, "the charge of perversion made it impossible for me to get a fair trial." In order to achieve a full and lasting vindication, Burns would have to cleanse Frank of that charge. And if he could, in the same artful motion, apply it to Jim Conley, Burns would surely be worth every penny of his enormous fee. Thus, the Frank team's strategy was to stress the act of rape in Mary Fagan's murder, and in so doing, the Frank team felt they could convince a predisposed white America that only a black man could be responsible for the brutal killing of this white girl. Dr. Stuart Rockoff concurs. Frank's trial lawyer, this is a quote from him, "Frank's trial lawyers also relied upon the stereotype of the black rapist to argue that Conley was the one most likely guilty of the crime. They argued that due to the sexually violent nature of the black men, Conley had to be the perpetrator of the crime." And here, Burns, using the high-profile forum provided by Adolf Ochs's New York Times, was especially creative. Under ludicrous headlines like, quote, Burns, besides clearing Frank, aims to fix 20 Ripper crimes on Negro, unquote, the world's greatest detective said he would be able to prove that Conley was the serial murderer of 20 black women in the Atlanta area over the previous 3 years. He contended that notes left at the scenes of those murdered Negro girls bore a marked resemblance to those at the Mary Fagan murder scene. No proof beyond the famous sleuth's own unchallenged word was offered, and none was asked for. In fact, according to a recent article on the Ripper, the only notes allegedly left by this serial killer materialized in March 1914 when firefighters found notes pinned to fireboxes around the city. The notes' author promised to, quote, cut the throats of all Negro women found in the streets after a certain hour of the night. The notes appeared a full 3 years after the murders began, and suspiciously at the exact same moment that Burns had entered the Leo Frank case. On Frank's alleged perversion, Burns readily shared his expertise. Quote, many perverts occupy high places in society and in business. It is not a difficult matter for me to locate one, however. Abnormality has its unfailing marks. Frank is a normal man. I am satisfied of this fact. He called in 6 physicians to examine Frank in 1 24-hour period, among them specialists on nervous diseases. No medical specialist needed for the black man James Conley, however, whom Burns insisted had a, quote, perverted brain. And Frank's public relations team of confirmed eugenicists went to work pairing James Conley with the word pervert at every opportunity. Attorney Reuben Arnold set the tone, reiterating that Conley was indeed bestial and that to call him a pervert is to pay him a compliment. At trial, Frank's attorneys had mocked as prudish those who raised questions about Frank's sexual improprieties. But now, when falsely applied to Conley, the defense treated such deviancy as a matter of national security. Yet another Frank lawyer insisted that to a black man there was no prize above life itself, direct quote, other than the privilege of debasing a white woman. But even as they ramped up their claims of perversion against James Conley, the higher-ups in the Frank team were secretly expressing real concerns about the sexual normalcy of their client, Leo Frank. PR team leader Albert Lasker's private view of Frank was harsh and disturbing. Quote, it was very hard for us to be fair to him. He, Leo Frank, impressed us as a sexual pervert. Now, he may not have been, or rather a homosexual or something like that. The us he was referring to are the two noted newspapermen who had joined Albert Lasker in his first meeting with Frank, the editor of the New York Evening Journal, Arthur Brisbane, and the editor of the Atlanta Georgian, Kate Speed, and the man whose very responsibility was to pin the pervert charge on James Conley, one William J. Burns. Kate Speed remembers the episode. And when we had got him out and started down the courthouse steps, Lasker hated him. He said, well, I hope he gets out. And when he gets out, I hope he slips on a banana peel and breaks his neck. None of this, of course, got beyond private correspondences of those involved, but it raises serious concerns about why they dedicated so much time, effort, and money to the cause of a man they seemed to all agree was a despicable character and very likely a murderer. Next section, the miraculous Carter letters. William J. Burns' arrival appeared to revive Frank's chances for a new trial. But Burns had boastfully proclaimed that he would find the murderer, not simply exonerate Leo Frank. If the actual murderer were not apprehended and proved guilty, Frank would remain under suspicion in the public's mind. So money man Albert Lasker wrote to Frank's attorney Herbert Haas on April 20, 1914, that Burns's fees would be in jeopardy unless he could provide some conclusive evidence of Frank's innocence. And if a confession by the murderer, other than Frank, could not be achieved, quote, it will hurt us and may do the case more harm than if he had not entered into it at all. In other words, in face of his promises to name the murderer, unless he names him in such a way as to be direct proof, The people in the North are in the frame of mind where they will feel that they have been fooled and it will hurt the case. I have seen many editorials along these lines, and I cannot begin to tell you the number of people who have spoken about it in this way. I note particularly the enormous bill that Burns is running up, $15,000 to $20,000. Believe me, my dear Mr. Haas, there is a limit to the money that can be raised, and unless Burns proves something direct, there is a limit that can be paid him. If William J. Burns detected anything in this case, it was the unsubtle message in Lasker's communique. Shortly thereafter, and perfectly on cue, Burns was able to announce his most important, quote, find yet, a series of letters he claimed were written by James Connolly. While he was incarcerated at the Atlanta jail, and addressed to a black female inmate named Annie Maud Carter. They were, the Frank team excitedly insisted, filled with proof of Connolly's perversion, showing him to be sexually abnormal, the very same terms widely applied to Leo Frank. Burns characterized the letters as both startling and dreadful. Quote, they show beyond a peradventure of doubt that Connolly is an abnormal man. Just the vile, degenerate creature that I have heretofore pictured him. They are full of the vilest, most abominable language, dealing with Connolly's lust. His perverted passion was aroused by her, and most of the letters are full of this vile stuff. It fills one with loathing disgust to even merely read them. They are the most nauseating things imaginable. The letters show, Frank quickly added, that Connolly is a vile degenerate, and practicer of unnatural crimes, which the law of this state punishes by life imprisonment in its penitentiary. The explosive new, quote, documents contain no Connolly confession, yet prove beyond all doubt that he, and he alone, had murdered Mary Fagan. The so-called Carter letters had the added value of clearing up a misinterpreted feature of the murder notes found next to the body of Mary Fagan. The prosecutor had convinced the jury that the murder notes were the product of Leo Frank's mind and not Connolly's because of the use of the words Negro and did when blacks were to use the words nigger and done. The Carter letter showed Connolly using both Negro and did, and thus they, quote, completely explode the argument of the state, Luther Rosser proclaimed. The discovery of the letters was indeed a miraculous stroke of good fortune for Leo Frank. Brimming with confidence, Leo Frank issued a public proclamation, quote, I submit to the people of Atlanta that Chief of Detectives Newport A. Lanford's bluff has been called. He knows perfectly well that the charge of perversion against me was a cowardly lie. I now make this solemn declaration. I am not a pervert, nor an immoral man. The charges against me, these charges, are a vicious mass of lies. But as the chest thumping seemed to signal a renewed hope for Frank, the woman who supposedly had received the correspondence, Annie Maud Carter, seemed to have disappeared. No one could question her about the letters or the circumstances of their appearance. The prosecutor, the press, the public, had only an affidavit attributed to her by Frank's defenders. Ms. Carter, it turns out, was in the custody of the William J. Burns Detective Agency in such an unusual arrangement that Judge Benjamin H. Hill would not accept the affidavit unless she could be questioned by the court. He held Burns in contempt and gave him a deadline to produce his witness. Once Carter was brought back under court order, the backstory of the letters changed quite dramatically from the Frank team version. Connolly had always denied writing the letters, and Carter, after first going along with the stunt, admitted they were forged and that she had actually worked in an undercover capacity for William J. Burns. The Atlanta Constitution reported, quote, she told Judge Hill that she had been sent away from Atlanta under direction of Detectives Burns and Dan Lahan, and that on one occasion she had been supplied with $5 pocket money. Two attorneys appeared in court to represent the Negress. One, George Gordon, stated to the court that he had been employed to represent the woman by Isaac Haas, Leo Frank's attorney. Carter claimed that she had not received any vulgar letters from Connolly, and she did not believe him to be a degenerate. As Burns's jailhouse plant, Carter had indeed talked to Connolly for 3 hours and concluded that Connolly is not a pervert. He gave her two or three letters, she admitted, but there was nothing vulgar in them. And contrary to a frank-placed rumor, she said Conley never confessed to her that he had murdered Mary Fagan. A clearly irritated Judge Hill had this exchange with Carter. Hill: after you made the affidavit, who first suggested that you leave? Carter: Mr. Burns and Mr. Dan Lahan suggested that I leave. Hill: why? Carter: they said I better go or I would not come in contact with the city detectives who would want me to make different statements. Hill: had you turned the letters over to them? Carter: I didn't see the letters until I got to New Orleans. Hill did not pursue that line of questioning, or at least the newspapers did not cover it, but Carter, who was supposed to have been the recipient of those letters while in that Atlanta jailhouse, claimed under oath that she did not see them until she was in another state altogether. Further, she identified Frank's attorneys, the Haases, as having arranged the entire operation. It seems that Carter had served her time as a cleaning woman at the jail, where in the course of her duties she had conversations with Conley. Carter made this association known to a Jewish Decatur Street pawnbroker named Jake Jacobs, and it was Jacobs who contacted the Frank team to suggest that they might take advantage of this woman's access to James Conley. Here's a very good example of Jews working as a damn team to evade the law and to lie and present. I mean, think about that. Just some random Jew who's a pawnbroker is trying to help his fellow Jew get out of a bind by lying. He has no direct interest in it. It just shows you the racial nature of the Jew. Carter testified that Jacobs had given her some jewelry, which she had in pawn, and that he had also given her a suitcase, quote, before she would allow him to take her before William J. Burns for an interview. The apparent result of that inducement was her participation in the scheme. As Carter sat before Judge Hill, she unhesitatingly and specifically repudiated the initial false affidavit that had come out of those shady associations. When asked who supplied the letters, Burns, now in the defensive, pled ignorance, but Judge Hill probed. Question: was that Dr. George Wren? Answer: I don't know. It was a man about 25 or 26 years old. Question: he is the man who furnished you with the translation of these letters. Answer: he translated them for me. Then Leonard Haas translated them. Question: when did you tell counsel for Frank about the notes? Answer: two of them, Messrs. Leonard and Herbert Haas, were present when I got them. Then Wren interpreted the notes. Question: how long did you have them in your possession before they were interpreted? Answer: 2 or 3 days. Question: who gave them to you? Answer: C.W. Burke. Question: then Burke deserves the credit for this. Answer: yes. Burke, lo and behold, was a detective that worked out of the office of Governor John M. Slayton, who was then the silent partner in the law firm of Luther Z. Rosser, Frank's attorney. It was later revealed during Burns' criminal trial that a veritable who's who of local Jewish leadership was present when the false affidavit was assigned to Annie Maud Carter. Rabbi David Marks led the group that included Isaac Haas, Isaac Schoen, B. Wildauer, J. O. Knight, notary, and Otto Schwab, all of whom were assembled for the ceremony in the law offices of Herbert and Leonard Haas. What's more, the, quote, handwriting expert who claimed the letters to be authentic had been hired by Frank's secretive financier, Albert Lasker. That Burns himself was once an expert in counterfeiting for the United States Secret Service further discredits the whole episode. So all this complete chicanery, illegal activity on behalf of the already convicted Leo Frank. Solicitor Hugh Dorsey stated to the court that the so-called Carter letters were, quote, founded upon falsehood. Quote, the said Conley denies the authorship of said letters. The circumstances indicate that Jim Conley never wrote any such letters, and the state insists that the letters produced, containing vulgar and obscene language and referring to indecent matters, are forgeries. Even though Frank's lawyers could take it no further in the judicial arena, such lurid and sensational tripe was made to order for the Lasker campaign. The team continued to push the letter so as to complete their evidentiary triad of rape, black men, and white girls. Author Jeffrey Melnick, quote, What is most disturbing about the projections of black rapists as the only possible villains in the Mary Fagan murder case is that many of them were explicitly authored by Frank's attorneys. Footnote 656. The fact is that many black girls had been lynched in the state. Many blacks had been lynched in the state for alleged relations with white women, none known to be with underage girls. If Frank were lynched solely for his sexual indiscretions, charges he and his lawyers conceded in open court, then his lynching is yet unremarkable, unjust, but unremarkable. Only Frank's whiteness, together with his Jewishness, raised the case to the status of notable lynching. As the leader of the most prominent organization of exclusively Jewish men, Frank and his B'nai B'rith did nothing as hundreds of black people were being lynched all around them. You got to understand that there's a lot of BS out there in false history. Oh, blacks were lynched. Yeah, fewer blacks were lynched, a few thousand, then we'll kill each other in a couple of cities or in the U.S. in an average year. Right, but also you have to understand, whites didn't just lynch blacks. They also lynched guilty whites. So it was not purely a racial thing. A lot of lying out there. You really have to track down the facts. Put your own truth on the march and don't do it in a fake way. That's what we're here to help you with. Burns's forged and fraudulent Carter letters were, writers have said, the missing piece in the defense claim that Conley, and not Frank, was responsible for the crime. A year later, Georgia's Governor John Slayton would rely heavily on these forgeries to justify his commutation of Frank's death sentence. Burns was undaunted as he triumphantly but prematurely announced, quote, I have absolutely cleared Leo Frank of the charge of perversion, which was wholly responsible for his conviction, and I have also demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jim Conley is a pervert and was the murderer of little Mary Fagan. That statement, though, was aimed more at proving to his employers that he had fulfilled the terms of his lucrative contract than at providing a true assessment of the proof he had gathered, proof in quotes. The so-called Carter letters remain yet more proof of the lengths Leo Frank was willing to go to destroy James Conley's personhood, his reputation, and his race. And it really is extraordinary. The private correspondence between Atlanta and Chicago really told it all. Herbert Haas wrote to Albert Lasker on May 2, 1914, quote, the situation is worse today than it ever has been. It is desperate. All of us feel that the situation is hopeless. Unless the Supreme Court of the United States sustains the constitutional point, Frank is a doomed man. It is the belief of nearly all of our friends that Burns's connection with the case has done us irretrievable damage. Next section, Carter's murder for hire. Annie Maud, and we're on page 262, I think we'll go up to 270 through 275. Annie Maud Carter had much more to say about her association with Leo Frank and his crew and revealed damning information that scholars of the case have heretofore ignored. Not only had this black woman publicly repudiated the letters Frank claimed she had exchanged with James Conley, but she revealed in a sworn affidavit that Frank's friends had actually tried to recruit her to poison Conley. She named two individuals, National Pencil Company stockholder Oscar Pappenheimer and Milton Klein, K-L-E-I-N, of Daniel Klein and Son, the B'nai B'rith member who publicly took credit for hiring William J. Burns. Even the New York Times, a certified member of the Frank team, had a report in its May 6, 1914 issue on the, quote, poison plot against Conley. Block quote here. One day, while walking past Frank's cell block, one of Frank's friends came to Carter and asked her if she wanted to get rich right quick. She said that the man asked her if she ever visited Jim Conley's cell. She said she answered that she was going there then. Thereupon, according to the affiant, Carter, the one swearing this, the friend of Frank said, in effect, take this vial and be mighty careful of it. Don't get any of it on you. It is dangerous. Just put a drop in the food that is given Conley. The woman said she replied that she did not want to have anything to do with killing anybody, and that Frank's friend said that she should not care anything about one Negro less, especially who had put the Fagan crime on Frank. She said that she did not know the man's name, but that he had black hair and wore his hat pulled down over his eyes. She said she had seen him in company with a man by the name of Pappenheimert, sick, and that he had come to Frank's cell with a Klein sick boy. She misspelled them, but Pappenheimer and Klein. Klein. None of this was ever pursued, either legally by the Georgia justice system or academically by students of the Leo Frank case. Many scholars are willing to validate her, quote, Negro testimony about the letters before Carter repudiated them in open court, but not her explicit testimony under oath about a murder-for-hire plot by the friends of Leo Frank. All of Georgia watched this entire Burns burlesque unravel before their eyes in the retrial hearing for Leo Frank. Judge Benjamin Hill did not even need to hear arguments from Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey before he denied Frank a new trial and set in motion an investigation into the tactics and methods of William J. Burns. Next section. So it's out of course, like, you guys are a bunch of clowns. In fact, if we look into you, we're probably going to find you're criminals, and they literally were multiple criminals in their attempt to defend Leo Frank after his conviction. Next subsection, more Burns chicanery. By May of 1914, Anne Maud Carter, Annie Maud Carter, had pulled the bandage off a festering wound, only to expose an underworld operation of major proportions. So many witnesses dredged up by Burns's dragnet were so plainly fraudulent that scholars today are embarrassed to mention them. The, quote, respected white preacher named C.B. Ragsdale admitted that his, quote, two darkies, quote, unquote, were complete fabrications and that Frank's team had paid him to lie. Quote, they were just handing money out, charged the clergyman. He had received $200 for his darkies story, a half year's pay for most of Frank's factory employees. A black woman named Mary Rich operated a lunch stand near the factory. On the day the murder was discovered, police found the basement door to the alleyway had been unlatched, and they later charged that Frank had unlocked the door to enable Conley to get in and burn the body of Mary Fagan. Burns claimed that he had an affidavit from Mary Rich, admitting that she had served Conley at 2:20 p.m. on the day of the murder, after seeing him emerge from the alleyway next to the factory. But nobody told Mary Rich, and she charged that the story was invented by none other than the local rabbi, David Marks, and Frank's own wife, Lucille. Excuse me. Mrs. Frank said to me, if you will sign this affidavit, you will take the rope from around my husband's neck. So you notice that, like, if you do a flip strength test, a spot check of Jews, basically every one of them is willing to lie, exactly like niggers. Isn't that interesting? Two other blacks charged that the Frank team simply forged their names on falsified affidavits. Yet another white woman detailed the efforts made, quote, to get her out of town, efforts that included an offer of $100 and a marriage proposal from an agent hired by Frank and using an alias. Much of the money, when it could be traced, seemed to come from Herbert J. Haas, Frank's other Jewish lead attorney, who was the conduit for Lasker's secret funds. But that is not all. Some of William J. Burns's ham-fisted attempts to pressure and bribe witnesses on Frank's behalf occurred at Governor Slayton's law firm and in Governor Slayton's own office. Unbelievable. In the end, Leo Frank's perjurious house of cards collapsed very publicly and completely. His manufactured, quote, revelations only fortified everyone's confidence in the original guilty verdict and layered upon that conviction new felonies, expanding the associated pool of criminals to include even more friends, associates, and hires of Leo M. Frank. William J. Burns so completely botched the task that he and his agent soon faced charges of subornation of perjury, hiding a Negro witness, bribery, inventing evidence, and buying testimony, illegalities that led to a revocation of Burns's license to practice in Atlanta. Proving himself to be the ultimate recanter, a remorseful Burns appeared in court and distanced himself from the Annie Maud Carter letters, in effect admitting they were faked. Attorney Reuben Arnold also repudiated the letters, saying in court, quote, Conley isn't a pervert. I don't believe there has been any perversion in the case on the part of Conley or of Frank. George's favorite son, Tom Watson, was monitoring all this in the pages of his weekly Jeffersonian. He mercilessly mocked the, quote, great detective, whom he simply renamed the Jackass. Quote, I think I said that Burns might trace a lost cow if she had a bell in her neck and toted a red light lantern at her tail. I now take that back. I was too hasty. My revised opinion is that Burns couldn't even find a lost cow unless she were equipped with a wireless telegraph outfit and regularly flashed out SOS signals every time she stopped to make water. Lewis Marshall despaired at the collapse of his team's efforts, privately calling Burns' methods ridiculous, these are direct quotes, and farcical and a burlesque. He said he was disgusted that Burns brought the case to this point of destruction. Tellingly, Marshall was not repudiating Leo Frank's blatantly racist defense strategy. He was simply scoring Burns' incompetence in carrying out his part of their racist plot. Even attorney Herbert Haas, ignoring his own role as Lasker's bagman in the fiasco, had to admit that Burns' connection with the case has done us irretrievable damage. Next section, the sleazy conduct of Leo Frank's private eyes. Some of the Burns operatives were forced to stand trial for just a portion of the avalanche of illegalities that included fraud, bribery, perjury, forgery, and even murder for hire. None of the higher-ups orchestrating the treachery, Lasker, Haas, Ox, Marshall, Marks, Frank, were ever held accountable for their roles in the bizarre episode. Only Tom Watson held them up for public ridicule in his monthly magazine. Quote, decidedly, it is the blackest record of systematic effort to save the guilty, destroy the innocent, debauch witnesses, manufacture evidence, and create a public sentiment in favor of a fictitious case. So Jews don't get, they don't succeed in their mission, but they get away with committing all kinds of crimes to defend their very worst criminal. Judge Hill scored the famous sleuths who were seeking, quote, not truth, but money and notoriety. He called them a menace to justice and declared, these men do not detect crime. Rather, they encourage crime. They are a menace to the peace of the state and an obstruction to the administration of justice. Albert Lasker finally admitted in 1937 what everyone already knew in 1914. Quote, Burns cost me $25,000 out of my own pocket, and by God, he put in as much perjured stuff as the other side did before we finished. I don't say he did. He had his operatives. I don't say he did. He had his operatives, I guess. You can run that sort of thing until it embarrassed our case at times. Lasker is here admitting to a serious felony for which he was never indicted. Judge Benjamin Hill talked tough, assessed fines, but in a surprising move, he dismissed some of the charges and ordered no prison time for Burns' gaggle of operatives. Turns out Lasker may have persuaded Judge Hill into granting Frank's felons an undeserved leniency. In a private letter to cohort Adolf Ox, dated March 12, 1914, Lasker seems to be assessing the opportunity for judicial bribery. Quote, the situation looks serious, for I found that Judge Hill comes up for re-election in June. He has a large family to support, and it is but 4 months since he resigned a position in a higher court where the salary was $4,000 a year to fill a vacancy by appointment in his lower court at $5,000 a year. This would not seem to augur well. There is no proof that any money changed hands, but it is hard to believe that Lasker's blatant query about the judge's personal finances could have had any other purpose. Below is a chart that catalogs the illegalities which have come to light that can be directly attributed to the Leo Frank legal team. And we've got about 2 pages of this. Now let's read. These are all the illegal things that were done on behalf of Leo Frank after. Maybe some during, but mostly maybe after. Charge. They're all going to be charge and description. Charge. Bribery of George Epps. Description. The 14-year-old Epps testified that Mary Fagan told him that Leo Frank had made sexual advances toward her. Burns' private detective, C.W. Burke, offered him money to change his testimony. Attempted bribery of Marie Karst. The former National Pencil Company employee had testified at trial that Frank's character for lasciviousness was bad. Karst now testified that Burke and Leo Frank's factory employee, Lemmy Quinn, had come to her home with liquor, intending to get her to agree to come to the home of Frank's lawyers. She refused. Then Burke met her on the street and offered her a job for $2 a day. That's like more than a week's wages. Or no. It's at least normal wages, plus a little more. Burke wanted me to go around and see the girls who had sworn for the state in the Frank trial and see if they would not change their evidence. He told me that what I swore to did not bind me because I was not cross-examined and said it was not recorded. I saw several of the girls, and they told me they would not change their evidence because what they swore to was true. Burke wanted me to see Montine Stover and talk with her and see if I could get her to change her evidence. He wanted me to go down and live with Montine and pick her. My mother refused to let me do it and would not let me work for Burke anymore. And that was from Marie Karst. Attempted bribery of Albert McKnight. McKnight, husband of the cook at Frank's home, was offered money and employment at high wages if he would swear that the injuries he had sustained in a railroad accident were caused by a beating by Atlanta detectives. Attempted bribery of Aaron Allen. William Burns brought Allen, a black man, to Chicago for several days, pressuring him to swear that Conley had confessed to him that he alone had committed the murder. Allen refused, despite large sums of money left on the table that were his for the taking. Charge, blackmailing of Carrie Smith. Private Detective C.W. Burke threatened Smith with the exposure of alleged misconduct at her place of employment if she did not change her trial statement in which she testified of Leo Frank's bad character. Smith, a factory employee for 3 years, swore that she was offered $20 to sign an affidavit favorable to Frank. That'd be $500 in today's money. The person bribing her was a Mr. Maddox, very likely Burke, using an assumed name, who made the offer in Governor Slayton's private office. She was also expected to try stealthily become a roommate of Montine Stover's to persuade her to change her testimony. Attempted bribery of Mrs. Maggie Nash. Mrs. Nash swore that Burns had tried to get her to change her testimony about seeing Frank go into a private room with a female employee. She refused, telling Burns he might try 100 years, but she would never do it. Attempted bribery of Helen Ferguson. Factory employee Ferguson testified that Frank had refused to give her Mary Fagan's pay envelope. It was this refusal on a Friday evening that compelled Mary to go to Frank herself to collect her pay the next day, whereupon she was murdered. Ferguson swore that Jimmy Wren, who worked for C.W. Burke, offered her $100 in all her expenses, that's $2,500 in today's dollars, if she would leave Atlanta. She said that Wren tried to persuade her to marry him and introduced her to his, quote, father. Quote, he said he wanted to marry me, but he wanted me to sign an affidavit first. Wren's father was Frank's private detective, C.W. Burke. Attempted bribery of C.B. Dalton. At the trial, Dalton confirmed Conley's account of Frank's sexual encounters. He swore that C.W. Burke had offered him $100 to sign a paper to be used before the pardon board to keep Frank from hanging. He said he had gone to Dublin, Georgia to do some work for a bank, and two Jews came to him and offered him $400 to leave the state. They came to him several times and renewed the offer, stating that they meant to get Frank a new trial. Forged evidence. Annie Maud Carter was used by Burns' agents to agree to claim to have received obscene letters from James Conley. Conspiracy to murder James Conley. According to Annie Maud Carter, a Jew came up, Mr. Oscar Pappenheimer, was there too, and offered a large sum of money if she would put poison in James Conley's food. Forged evidence. Frank's team forged the time slip of factory night watchman Newt Lee to make it appear that he had time to leave the factory on the night before the murder. Planted evidence. A shirt wiped in blood was planted at the home of Newt Lee, a deception that made him the target of lynching threats. Lee was fully exonerated, and it was established that the bloody shirt was planted by Frank's legal team. Planted evidence. Wooden club, quote, found, unquote, by Pinkerton detectives in a previously searched area of the factory, was claimed by Frank to be the murder weapon used by Conley. Factory employee Wade Campbell, however, testified at the trial that on the day of the murder, Frank, quote, had a club which he used to play with in his hand, and he was carrying it around. Planted evidence. An ADL report addresses the, quote, discovery of Mary Fagan's pay envelope by a detective hired by Frank. Quote, the mysterious pay envelope, bearing not a single fingerprint of any kind, even a smudge, had to have been a plant. Bribery of Reverend C.B. Ragsdale. The former pastor of a local church testified he was paid $200 for citing a false affidavit, claiming he had overheard Conley confess to the murder. Isn't that funny? Like, the guy who actually takes the money is the reverend. Forged letter of the dead Judge Roan. A letter that appeared after the death of trial judge Leonard S. Roan, expressing doubt about Frank's guilt, was believed by his family and solicitor Dorsey to be forged by Frank's legal team. Forged affidavit. Ivy Jones testified that Conley was not drunk on the day of the murder. Jones said his affidavit to the contrary was forged. Forged affidavit. Ruth Robinson testified that Frank had made an indecent proposal to her, but her testimony was retracted in a false affidavit by C.W. Burke. Forged affidavit. Rabbi David Marks and Mrs. Leo Frank approached black food vendor Mary Rich and tried to force her to sign a false affidavit that helped Frank's alibi. She refused, but they submitted it anyway. So the rabbi and the wife make a forged affidavit. Forged affidavit. Mrs. J.B. Simmons was induced by C.W. Burke to sign a false statement against solicitor Hugh Dorsey. Burke brought her a basket of fruit in payment. So that ends the list of all these criminal activities on behalf of the defense of Leo Frank. And as they say, this list is by no means the full extent of the criminal operations of the agents working on behalf of Mr. Leo M. Frank. Despite the scope and seriousness of these crimes, most were not adjudicated, and those responsible received only fines and no jail time. Burns had his license revoked. Burns's cohort, Dan Lahan, was expelled from the Chicago Police Department for bribery and conduct unbecoming of an officer. Burns's agent, C.W. Burke, and Jimmy Wren appear to have gotten away scot-free. As incredible as all this sounds, Burns parlayed this sleazy resume into a directorship of the Federal Bureau of Investigation from 1921 until another scandal forced him to resign in 1924. Under oath and before Judge Hill, solicitor Hugh Dorsey finally had the opportunity to question William J. Burns. Quote, during your investigation, what criminal act did you ever discover that Conley had committed? Answer, quote, I don't know that I've discovered any. It's all a bunch of BS. And then to conclude this session, we've got a few pages out of newspapers. Leo Frank's massive criminal insurgency. In 1914, Leo Frank's forces unleashed a wave of criminality, the scope of which is unprecedented. The details of the operation were captured in rare fashion in this article, quote, Return of Negress Ordered by Judge, by reporters of the Atlanta Constitution, May 5, 1914, covering the trial of the agents and operatives of the William J. Burns Detective Agency. All right, and this goes on for five pages, 271 to 275, and this will finish this session. Let's read it now. Return of Negress Ordered by Judge. If Anna, rather than Annie as we've been hearing, Anna Maud Carter is not in Atlanta within 5 days, her evidence will not be considered. charges of bribery, perjury, and coercion of witnesses will be thoroughly investigated by Solicitor Dorsey, and then a number of prosecutions will follow, according to a statement by the solicitor on Monday night. Quote, prosecutions will certainly follow later on, he said. It will be my duty as a prosecuting officer to see that justice is done. Outside of that, I can say nothing else, except that the scope of my prosecutions will include all who have been guilty of crookedness, even the men higher up. Judge Ben Hill demanded of Leo Frank's defense yesterday afternoon that Anna Maud Carter, the Negro witness, be returned to the jurisdiction of the court within 5 days. He declared that if she were not brought back to Atlanta within that time, he would decline to consider her evidence or any evidence in which she was involved. Quote, Detective Burns admitted before me, said Judge Hill, that he had sent Anna Maud Carter from the jurisdiction of the court. I want an order drawn commanding Anna Maud Carter to be returned to Atlanta in 5 days, or I will not consider any of the evidence in which she is concerned. A few minutes later, Judge Hill supplemented his statement with these words, quote, In making this demand, I do not mean to reflect on the counsel for Leo for Frank. It was testified before me that Detective Burns had removed the Carter woman. Subhead, will bring woman back. It is said that immediate efforts will be made to bring the missing woman back to Atlanta. She is now in New Orleans, where, according to a letter she recently wrote relatives in this city, she is working with the William J. Burns Detective Agency. This letter was read to Judge Hill by Solicitor Dorsey Monday afternoon. Anna Maud Carter is the negress who accuses Jim Conley of having confessed to her the murder of Mary Fagan. A literal mountain of evidence was introduced by the solicitor Monday to show that she had conspired with George and Jimmy Wren in Fulton Jail to frame up on Conley. Other testimony was adduced to show that she had told friends and relatives upon being released from jail that she had tried to, quote, pick Conley, and that he had firmly maintained that Leo Frank was the murderer. Regarding the Carter woman, Attorney Arnold was asked by a reporter for the Constitution if lawyers for Frank or the Burns agents would seek to bring the woman back to the city. Mr. Arnold smiled in reply, saying that he did not know as yet. A surprising new phase of evidence that arose Monday was an affidavit from Mrs. Hattie Waits, the young wife of J.M. Waits, who swears that on the morning of the day Mary Fagan was slain, she saw Leo Frank and Jim Codley talking to each other sometime between 10 and 11 o'clock, and that they were apparently engaged in earnest conversation. This evidence was introduced to bear out, in part, that portion of Conley's testimony, bearing with the meeting he swore he had with Frank on the morning of the 28th at Forsyth and Nelson Streets, when Frank is alleged to have instructed him to come to the pencil factory that noon to, quote, watch for him. Mrs. Waite's affidavit has been kept a secret by the solicitor and created a sensation when it was sprung. Subhead, Lehan nears contempt. At the very outset of the retrial proceedings Monday morning, a sensation was created when Dan S. Lehan, Southern Superintendent of the William J. Burns Forces, was practically put under arrest for contempt of court. Following the strenuous examination which he underwent before Solicitor Dorsey, he made a heated tirade against the solicitor's tactics. They were cut short by Judge Hill, however, who ordered him to cease, and who instructed Deputy Sheriff Plenty Minor to take charge of the Burns man. Minor escorted Lehan into an adjoining room where he remained for some little while. Later, Judge Hill asked the court stenographer to read that part of Lehan's statement which attacked Dorsey. Attorneys Arnold and Rosser stated that the witness had not intended to be in contempt. Judge Hill ordered the words expunged from the record, called Deputy Minor into the room, and ordered that Lehan be allowed to go his way. Only two witnesses were examined, Lehan and L.P. Eubanks. Mary Rich, the negress who was alleged by the defense to have made an affidavit in which she stated she saw Jim Codley emerge from the rear of the pencil plant at 2:15 o'clock on the tragedy date, has made an affidavit in which she denies having made the document submitted by the defense. A fake affidavit. Subhead, refused to sign paper. Sometime recently, she swears, Mrs. Lucille Frank, his wife, and Rabbi Marks, and two men came to see me and tried to get me to make an affidavit. The affidavit was not true, and I refused to sign it. This is Mary Rich. Mrs. Frank said to me, if you will sign this affidavit, you will take the rope from around my husband's neck. I replied that I could not tell a lie and that to sign the paper would be telling a lie. Quote, one man with Mrs. Frank and Rabbi Marks tore off a little piece of the paper that was in his hands. This man was C.W. Burke. He said, you take this paper. I told him that I did not want the paper, and he said, this will not hurt you, but you keep this paper. It is just for you, so that you will know it when you see it again. I took it and kept it. I showed it in a few minutes afterward to Mr. F.J. Wellborn, a man that I have known a good long time, who was standing by when these people were talking to me. Afterwards, I took the paper to somebody in the office of Solicitor General Hugh N. Dorsey. I have looked at the piece of paper attached to the affidavit signed by F.J. Wellborn, and it looks to be about the size and shape of the paper which Burke gave me. Burke also told me that if I got into trouble, I might know the cause of it. Dorsey presented a number of affidavits dealing with an alleged conspiracy within the county jail between Anna Maud Carter and Dr. George Wren and Wren's brother, Jimmy Wren, to frame up on Jim Connolly. Dr. George Wren was a prisoner serving a sentence for complicity in the Gilsey diamond robbery. One angle of this evidence is an affidavit from Frank Reese, an ex-prisoner who lives at 7 Kingsley Street. He was a trustee prisoner in the tower, worked in the prison laundry, and did odd jobs required of trustees. I have heard Dr. Wren telling Connolly that he had been tried, that he, Connolly, could take the Mary Fagan murder on himself, and that it would free Mr. Frank, said Reese, and that Connolly could never be tried any more for it. Connolly refused to consider this. Saw them talking. Wren talked to Fred Perkerson, another prisoner, and myself several times and tried to get us to agree to go into Connolly's cell and come out and claim that Connolly had confessed to us. He said we would get lots of money if we did. I knew Annie Maud Carter, and I have seen her and Dr. Wren talking together very often. I saw Annie Maud Carter go to Connolly's cell once, and Fred Perkerson called to her that if she went in, she would be locked up. Both Fred and I knew she was crooked, and we cautioned Jim Connolly about her. I saw Dr. Wren at one time throw a note to Annie Maud Carter from the second floor. She carried it to Connolly's cell, pitching it through the bars of the wing door. Quote, when I got out of jail, Dr. Wren came to my house at 1 morning at 7 o'clock with a long white paper asking me to sign it. I could not read or write, and I told him I wanted to wait and see what was in the paper. He said that it was just a paper to the effect that I had carried notes from Jim Connolly to Annie Maud Carter. I did not know what was in it, and so I wouldn't sign it. He said that, inasmuch as I couldn't write, he'd write it for me. I told him I wouldn't authorize anybody to write for me, nor sign my name to anything, unless I was aware of its contents. Fred Perkerson, the prisoner alluded to in the Reeves affidavit, has signed a statement to the effect that C.W. Burke, the private investigator attached to Luther Z. Rosser's office, and Jimmy Wren, Burke's assistant, I think that's a typo, and Dr. George Wren, the convict named in the Reeves affidavit, have often conferred with Leo Frank in Frank's cell in the tower. He told a similar story of alleged conspiracy in which Wren figured to frame up on Connolly. He swears that Wren told him, and Reeves makes, that they were in a position to make a lot of money and advised them to go into Connolly's cell and, upon coming out, pretend that Connolly had confessed to Mary Fagan's murder. He declares that he asked Wren why Wren himself didn't do this. Wren is said to have replied that he didn't care to get mixed up in the case. Ivy Jones, the Negro from whom the defense, in its new trial motion, purported to have obtained an affidavit recanting his testimony at the trial, has made an affidavit for the solicitor swearing that the defense affidavit is false and that it is a forgery. Dorsey attacked the defense argument that the notepaper on which Connolly wrote the murder notes was obtained from the basement when he introduced a number of affidavits in rebuttal. One of these was from Philip Chambers, an ex-office boy in Frank's employ, who was a witness for the defense at Frank's trial. Subhead, nothing sent to basement. Chambers testifies now that Becker, upon leaving the employ of the pencil factory, moved his desk into Mr. Frank's office, and that it was thereafter used by Frank. He swears that no trash, books, or paper ever stayed down in the basement, and that all order blanks left upon Becker's departure were used by Frank. J.M. Gant makes an affidavit in this phase to the effect that the order blanks were never destroyed, and at no time did he ever see any of the scratch pads sent in the trash to the basement. The trash, Gant swears, was burned with all the rubbish every day in the furnace in the basement. Another affidavit bearing on this angle was one made by H.H. Otis, city fire inspector, who declares he was forced at numerous times to remind Leo Frank of negligence in keeping with the basement regulations. In keeping the basement regulated in compliance with fire ordinances, he instructed that all trash and rubbish be burned each day. He swears that he heard Frank give Darley, the assistant superintendent, specific instructions to burn all refuse and to see that none of it remained unburned in the basement or anywhere in the factory building. Otis further testifies that such litter was burned under his personal supervision from April 1, 1913. R.M. DeVore, a photographic expert attached to the AK Hardware Optical Concern, has made an affidavit swearing that he photographed the murder notes for Solicitor Dorsey and that he used a special color plate for the task, sending north for it. He says that, in his opinion, the number on the disputed blank is 1818. He also swears that T.A. Alexander, who recently issued a booklet bearing on the notes, admitted to him that he had instructed the photo engraver who made the plates to touch them up a bit. Much interest was centered around the J.E. Duffy affidavit, which was submitted by Dorsey during the afternoon. Duffy, who is purported by the defense to have renounced his trial testimony, now upholds it, and swears that he was induced by agents of the defense to make the recanting document. He says that L.P. Eubanks, the car inspector whom Dorsey grilled on the stand Monday morning, and C.W. Burke had offered him money to sign a false paper and told him that whenever he wanted money, they would furnish him with it. He swears that he has borrowed in the neighborhood of $30 from Eubanks. Quote, on April 30th of this year, his affidavit reads, Jimmy Wren took me in an automobile over the city, carrying me to dinners and cafes and to shows, and then riding me toward Austell, Georgia. I slept all night in the automobile. They brought me back the next day, and when we stopped in front of Marietta Chairworks on Marietta Street, we were surrounded by a crowd of Jews who pressed me with many questions bearing on my testimony. Subhead, lent Duffy money, D-U-F-F-E-Y. B.E. Duffy, father of Duffy, has made a statement saying that Eubanks had told him that he was lending young Duffy money and taking his note for same, but that the father need not worry as his son would never have to pay it back. Young Duffy has been released from prison in which he was lodged Friday night on an attachment issued by Judge Hill. C. Brutus Dalton, who the defense alleged some time ago had made an affidavit repudiating his testimony at the trial, was brought to Atlanta Monday by Detective John Black from Fort Myers, Florida. His new affidavit, which was introduced by Dorsey in the afternoon, sprang a decided sensation. Dalton says that he was visited at Fort Myers by C. W. Burke, who asked for his signature to a document which was to be presented before the Pardon Board of Georgia in order to prevent the hanging of Frank. Dalton says he was offered $100 and a ticket to Atlanta for his signature. Burke, Dalton swears, had a typewritten copy of some statement. He, according to the witness, read a part of it in which nothing was stated about a reversal of testimony. He signed the document, he states, expecting to receive the $100. That night, however, when he went to the hotel, Burke had disappeared, he states, and no $100 was in evidence. Dalton's affidavit contains part of his trial testimony, which he upholds, in which he tells of having seen Frank carry girls and women into the dressing rooms after he had been seen hugging and kissing them. Dalton also swore to having carried beer and other drinks for Frank in Frank's office, where the latter, he alleges, was entertaining girls and young women. An attack was made upon the testimony of Mrs. M. Jaffe, the wife of the Mitchell Street jeweler, who made an affidavit telling of having seen Frank at 1:30 o'clock on the streets on the murder date. An affidavit was presented from Detective Bass Rosser, who swears to having gone to Jaffe's jewelry shop in answer to a call to police headquarters. The husband, according to Rosser's affidavit, was seeking the aid of the police to find his wife, who he said had run away to Birmingham to meet another man, and upon departing had taken a ring belonging to a customer. Mrs. Jaffe, it is stated in the detective's testimony, later was returned and admitted to having taken the ring. This affidavit, however, was not admitted by Judge Hill. The affidavit of Reverend C.B. Ragsdale, the preacher who accuses the defense and Burns agents of bribery, accuses Arthur Thurman, his attorney, of having engineered the conspiracy against Connolly, in which the pastor was the most important figure. Thurman, he states, had been his attorney for some time and was acquainted with his financial affairs. Several days before the Ragsdale affidavit was made public, Thurman had informed the minister, Ragsdale swears, that he could make a lot of money out of the Frank case if Ragsdale would frame a statement to be used in Frank's defense. Ragsdale swears that he arranged such a statement and submitted it to Thurman, who pronounced it weak in spots, but who said that he could strengthen it wherever necessary. Later, he says, Thurman told him that he had got a Negro to corroborate him. The Negro, however, fell down, according to the minister's statement, and Thurman asked that someone else be procured who could assist the preacher in his tale. Ragsdale swears that he got R.L. Barber to make a similar statement. The frame-up was arranged to perfection, Ragsdale swears, and four or five subsequent conferences were held over the matter. On April 24, Ragsdale testified, C.C. Tedder, the Burns man, was called into the affair and carried Ragsdale to the Burns office in the Healy building, where he was introduced to Dan S. Lahan. Lahan, Ragsdale states, took the minister to the office of attorney Luther Z. Rosser, where a stenographer took his, quote, framed, unquote, statement. The affidavit then goes on to state how $200 was procured by Ragsdale and $100 by Barber through the agencies of Thurman and Tedder. The name of Lahan also figures prominently in the alleged transaction. Helen Ferguson swore that she was enmeshed by the defense agents by Jimmy Wren, who, under the assumed name of J.W. Howard, made love to her, spent money lavishly on her, and finally proposed marriage and carried her to C.W. Burke, whom he introduced under the guise of his father, her prospective father-in-law, at which time her affidavit was obtained. Ferguson affidavit. Her new affidavit for the state follows. Quote, Georgia, Fulton County. Personally appeared before the undersigned Miss Helen Ferguson, who, on oath, after being duly sworn, deposes as follows. Colon, since the Frank trial last summer, in which I gave testimony that was against Leo M. Frank, two attempts have been made either to get me to leave the city or change my testimony, the first by money, and the second by having a young man make love to me and offering to marry me. Make love didn't mean sex back then. It meant, like, wooing, essentially. Courting. Shortly after the trial, I left home one morning to go to my work, and on a street corner, a young man who was a Jew came up to me and said he would give me $100 and pay my board and all my expenses if I would leave Atlanta. As Frank was going to get a new trial sometime soon, he said, I refused and turned and walked away. That's about all he had time to say to me. He had a light mustache and light curly hair and looked like a man about 30 years old. The second attempt, after the money offer failed, occurred in December during the 2 weeks just before Christmas. I was working then at the Clark Woodenware Company on Foundry Street, having left the Marcus Loeb overall Company because I was afraid of the foreman whom I worked under, Mr. Levin, who tried before the trial to get me to swear for Frank and not against him, and that I was afraid of him and left soon afterward. When I left my work at the Clark Woodenware Company one afternoon in December, I was walking down the street with another girl when a young man, whom I afterwards found out to be Jimmy Wren, stepped up to us and said, "Howdy do, Miss Ferguson?" I said, "I don't remember you." And he answered, "This is Mr. J.W. Howard. Don't you remember when you worked at Block's?" "I worked there, too. I wanted to meet you then, but I didn't have a chance." And so that was the way I met him. A night or two later, he took me to the show and also met me several other times and was always mighty nice to me, just like a young man is, you know. I hadn't known him more than 2 days before he began to make love to me. A few days after I met him, we were walking uptown together when we met a big, heavy fellow with a big, round face who was standing in the corner and whom I have since found out was Mr. C.W. Burke, the detective. Jimmy Wren, or Howard as he called himself at that time, stopped and introduced me to him as his father. Burke, that is. We stood in the corner and talked for several minutes. The, quote, father got to talking about the couple who were caught spooning on the Capitol steps, and from this he began to say awful things about the police, saying they were, quote, no good, and that the city detectives were, quote, crooks, and other such things. He said something about wanting to make me to make a new statement in the Frank case, and I said, no, sir. And then, as we turned to leave, he said to Mr. Howard, bring her up to the office tonight. I want to talk to her anyhow. That night, Mr. Howard came out to the Clark Woodenware Company at 9 o'clock, when I got off from work, to take me to a town to see a show. There were about half a dozen of us girls who did extra work until 9 o'clock, a few nights for a while before Christmas. Jimmy was making real love to me that night. He said a lot about caring for me and wanting to marry me, but he kept on talking about wanting me to sign an affidavit about the Frank case affair. First, I didn't want to go up to any office with him, but he insisted so strongly and said his father was waiting for us that he just made me go. He took me up in that big gray-colored building on Broad Street. They call it the Grant Building, I believe. He took me up to the elevator, and there was an office his, quote, father was waiting for us. I remember seeing the name J.H. Porter on the door of the office. They asked me again to change my statement in the Frank case and say it was some other time that Mr. Frank had refused to give me Mary Fagan's pay envelope than the time I said it was. They said that Frank was an innocent man and that everybody knew it. But I said I had told nothing but the truth and wasn't going to change it. And then Jimmy said, well, I'd hate to be the main one to put a rope around Frank's neck. And I said I couldn't help that, since I had only told the truth. Then he talked some more about loving me so much, saying he wished I'd do it for him, until I was worried a good deal and wishing I was out of there. While we were talking about the Frank case in this way, I happened to tell them that I was afraid of Jim Codley. They then dropped the talk about my evidence and fixed up an affidavit for me to sign about Conley, which I signed in order to satisfy them. I simply said in this how Conley had approached me the Saturday before Mary Fagan was killed, when I was picking up some boxes and had offered to help me, and I had dropped the boxes and run because I was afraid of him. When we got that affidavit fixed up, we left. It seemed like we had been brought there an awful long time. We had been there an awful long time. Jimmy brought me home in an automobile that night and kept on talking love to me, and just before we got home, he tried to kiss me, and I hit him in the mouth. That seemed to cool him down, and he brought me to the door and said goodbye. I've never seen him but one time since that night. I found out a few days later that his real name was Jimmy Wren and not Howard. I found it out from a number of persons who had seen me with him and who knew all about his working at the National Pencil Factory and working with the lawyers and detectives for Frank. It was several weeks after that I found that his father was the detective C.W. Burke. When they decided that the time had come for giving my affidavit to the papers, a newspaper reporter came out to the house to see me about it. He told me how the affidavit had been given out through Burke and described him to me, and the description made it very plain that he was none other than the quote-unquote father. I also learned then that the office of J.W. Porter was up in the Grant Building right next to Mr. Luther Rosser's. I have found out in other ways that the, quote, father was Mr. Burke, many other people describing him to me very exactly. I know I could recognize Jimmy's, quote, father again the minute I saw him. Helen Ferguson, sworn to and subscribed before me this 7th day of April, 1914, signed L.L. Hildebrand, Notary Public, Fulton County, Georgia. The examination of Dan Lahan was the first proceeding on the program of Monday's session. Lahan was asked numberless questions regarding his operations on the Frank case, the source of his pay, and of the Ragsdale incident. It was at the close of his interrogation that he came near suffering punishment for contempt of court. Here is how the stenographer recorded his final words verbatim. Quote, "Can I make a statement, Judge, in reference to this case?" "Yes, you may make an explanation if you desire," answered Judge Hill. Quote, "I am an American citizen," retorted Lahan, "and I have been in the police business for 20 years. These questions asked here are the most outrageous questions I have ever been asked." He was cut short by the judge, who said, "You cannot state that. It is not admissible." Quote, "This is the most outrageous treatment," continued the witness, "from the district attorney." Again he was stopped, Judge Hill saying, "You cannot state that, Mr. Witness. I will have to send you to jail if you persist." Quote, "I don't mean any discourtesy to the court, any disrespect to the court," said Lahan. Lahan, in naming the source from which he obtained money, frequently mentioned the name of Herbert J. Haas, an attorney for the defense. He said that Boots Rogers was employed by the Burns Agency, and that Carlton C. Tedder was also attached to the Burns forces. He told of having paid C.C. Tedder $250 on his salary a short time previous to the Ragsdale affidavit. He said the money had been obtained from Haas, from whom he procured most of his fees. He stated that the fees and money turned over to him by Haas were in check form, and that the checks were turned over to C.E. Sears, superintendent of the Burns Agency. The retrial hearing was adjourned by Judge Hill Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. It will be resumed this morning at 10 o'clock. And that's where we'll leave it for today, at the end of 275. And that was a long article. It's talking about the various multi-level crookedness engaged in by Leo Frank's team after the verdict. Thoroughly rotten, thoroughly corrupt, thoroughly pathetic. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. This was more from the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, number 3, and it's The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews series put out by the Nation of Islam and their researchers out of Chicago. I'll be back with you again real soon.